Hello, it's time for the Des Moines Register on Monday, April 15, Tax Day. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. My name is Twyla Glenn, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Nicole Tam. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register with some from USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries. I will tell you we have no obituaries for today, so we'll go directly from birthdays into more news. That will include opinion, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can help keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and headlines from today's Des Moines Register. According to AccuWeather, across the state, it should be breezy and remain very warm today. Mostly cloudy, but increasing cloudiness in the north and to the east. Winds southeast, 10 to 20 miles per hour. And the forecast through the next few days for central Iowa looks like this. Today and tonight, a high of 81 and a low of 60, mostly cloudy and very warm Monday, breezy in the afternoon, winds southeast 10 to 20 miles per hour. A heavy thunderstorm Monday night, winds southeast 10 to 20 miles per hour. On Tuesday, showers, more heavy thunderstorms with a high of 72 and a low of 52. On Wednesday, mostly cloudy and breezy with a high of 64 and a low of 44. And on Thursday, mostly cloudy with a high of 57 and a low of 34. Tracking precipitation, in the 24 hours ending 4 p.m. Saturday, we've had zero precipitation. The month to date, we've had 53 hundredths of precipitation against a normal of 1.44 hundredths. Our year to date shows 5.24 hundredths of precipitation against a normal of 6 9/100. Last year on this date, we had had 5.7 inches of precipitation. Sunrise today, 6:34 a.m. Sunset tonight, 7:56 p.m. Moonrise today, 11:48 a.m. And moonset today, 2:59 a.m. tomorrow morning. Turning now to the headlines on the front page of the Register, the lead story reads Tyson plant closure to deal a blow to immigrant workers. Also included on the front page, the poll reports a steep odds for Biden in Florida, and the Des Moines City Council is set to vote on a $975 million city budget. Now here with the first story is Nicole.
We'll start with that Tyson plant closure story from F. Amanda Tuggate. Navigating U.S. unemployment system, transition careers among challenges. In January 2006, Ignacio Calderon reached his 10th anniversary at Tyson Foods in Perry. A photo capturing his career milestone and his youthful bearded face serves as proof. Calderon was 36 years old and married with four young children. 10 years of steady work and decent pay at the pork plant gave the Michoacan Mexico native a chance to put down roots in central Iowa. He bought a home in Perry and a car, and in another 5 years, he and his wife would then welcome their fifth child. That's why news of the plant's permanent closure hit him hard. Calderon, who's now 53, says that he never imagined the company to which he devoted nearly half of his life would be closing for good, replacing his livelihood with uncertainty. Calderon said in an interview in Spanish, "It was a big surprise for all of us. We were all stressed out, sad. This was a big deal, and nobody knew that this was going to happen." Calderon is among the immigrant workers at Tyson who spoke to the Des Moines Register about the challenges that he and others will soon face once this plant closes this summer. For many of them, Tyson had been their first and only employer, and they're nervous about navigating unemployment in the U.S. for the first time. They say they don't know what social benefits they qualify for, how to apply, and who they can turn to for help. They also say that Tyson hired them at a good wage despite their lack of skills and inability to speak English, and worry whether other employers could provide similar opportunities and chances to learn. Jan Flora, the Emeritus Professor of Sociology at Iowa State University, who has co-authored books on the impact of immigrants on rural communities, said the meatpacking industry has long relied on immigrants and refugees to build up its workforce. Flora says they come in large numbers and are willing to, quote, do the work at rates that no longer appeal to native-born applicants. But mass layoffs like Tyson's leave already marginalized groups even more vulnerable. This is according to Nicole Novak, research assistant professor at the University of Iowa's Department of Community and Behavioral Health. Novak says research has found that workers who have a harder time transitioning to other industries, often this is older workers, are especially at risk for symptoms of depression and other mental health concerns after involuntary job loss. Workers who face other barriers to switching industries, such as language barriers, may need that extra support to find meaningful and sustainable employment after losing a packing plant job. Tyson Foods has announced its plans last month to permanently close the pork packaging plant in Perry by June 28th. Tyson is the city's largest employer, and its departure will leave 1,276 people without a job and a small town in distress. The company has transformed Perry into one of the most diverse and fastest-growing communities in the state. Nearly 70% of employees at the Tyson location in Perry are Black and Latino. This is according to Roger Kale, the president of the United Food and Commercial Workers Local 1149. They represent 700 to 800 of the plant's workers. Women also make up close to 40%, the data provided by Kale shows. Those figures mirror Tyson's workforce across the U.S., made up of more than 60% minority groups and 39% women. This is according to a 2023 annual U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission report from the company. Close to a third of Perry's 8,000 residents identify as Hispanic or Latino, and almost 19% are foreign-born, according to the U.S. Census. Perry officials did recently unveil Perry Next, a new page on the city's website that lists events, career services, and other resources for those workers who are impacted by this closure. It is one of many efforts that's rolled out by leaders looking to ease the transition and search for a new job. A Tyson spokesperson said in an email that we understand the impact of our decision on our team members and the local community. They claim that they're working with local and government agencies in Perry. The officials do encourage all affected employees to consider positions within the company, according to the spokesperson. There will be assistance for individuals who choose to relocate to another facility. A collective bargaining agreement between the union and Tyson leaders, obtained by the Register, outlines benefits that's available to workers who physically relocate to Tyson's Waterloo plant. Of the 75 available jobs, 15 are for general maintenance positions. The remaining 60 are for hourly frontline team members, but the agreement doesn't otherwise specify the type of work that's involved. These employees who accept a position and move on to Waterloo will then be eligible to receive $10,000 from Tyson. The first $5,000 will be given after a month of employment at the new location. The other half will be given after 1 year of employment, according to the agreement. Up to $5,000 also will be offered to alleviate any moving cost, and the company will also provide helping children enroll into school and childcare. For the workers who relocate to plants other than Waterloo, housing assistance will also be offered. The company says that it will retain employees' seniority for health benefits, vacations, and holiday pay. These offers are available through June 28th, according to the agreement. A spokesperson did decline to comment on the details of the bargaining agreement and assistance that it would provide employees that's impacted by this plant closure. Calderon says there is no way he would make the commute to Tyson's other location when the nearest ones to Perry are still so far away. The facility in Storm Lake is about an hour and 50-minute drive, while the one in Waterloo is over 2 hours. Uprooting his family is an unrealistic option, he says. Before we move on to the next section, there is a large image of the Iowa Works Mobile Workforce Center. It's stationed right outside of the Perry plant. Again, that vehicle has resources and people inside to help those workers who are impacted by this closure. So the next part of the story talks about how am I going to survive? African refugees are asking after layoff news. Employees Kelozo Amisi and Jose Mazingo also were caught off guard by this closure. They said that they feel unprepared to handle the uncertainty that lies ahead. Amisi and Mazingo each came as refugees from Africa less than a decade ago. They became financially stable and independent because of Tyson. Mazingo, who came to the U.S. from a refugee camp in Zambia, says that he moved to Iowa in October of 2017 when he couldn't find a job in Las Vegas, Nevada. He was also told that the Des Moines area had more job opportunities and companies such as Tyson Foods were hiring immigrants and refugees. Mazingo had worked for Tyson Foods for the last 6.5 years and is considered the breadwinner in his family. He says that he's made good money, which has helped him and his wife pay their bills, including their monthly mortgage and college tuition for their children. Mazingo told Reverend Willie Misiando, a local leader in Des Moines in this African community, who provided translations from Swahili and Kibambi to the Register. Mazingo told him, saying, "I'm asking myself, how am I going to survive?" Siendo, senior pastor at Living Western Evangelical Free Church of Des Moines, and Trisha Gabriel, co-founder of the nonprofit Genesis Youth Foundation, says that they empathize with all the workers, many of whom have dedicated years to the Perry packing plant and will soon be let go. Those jobs help them find their footing in the new country. The company hired people with varying language skills. It's an opportunity, Siendo says, that's hard to come by and tough to pass up for immigrants and refugees. Siendo recalled the plant once hiring 11 new arrivals that he had referred. Gabriel says they're basically starting from scratch to figure out what's next for them. Gabriel also serves as the nonprofit's arts program director. Mazingo says he's afraid that employers will overlook him because of his age and because he has struggled to learn English. He says that he also struggles to apply online for jobs. "I don't know all the technology," he says. Amisi had similar concerns. The 43-year-old said he came to Iowa in 2019 from a refugee camp in Tanzania, and then immediately started working in Perry at the Tyson facility. It is the only job that he has had since coming to America. Over the last few weeks, Gabriel and her husband, Sam Gabriel, have held town hall-style meetings at public libraries for African families that's impacted by Tyson's closure. The couple, along with other community leaders and partners, listened as those workers candidly voiced their concerns. Some of the participants pitched in, helping usher the conversation and translating responses to English from Swahili and French. The Gabriels say that they understand the fear that these families feel. They came to Iowa with their families more than 20 years ago after living in an Ivory Coast refugee camp. They then built their nonprofit, which started with sports and arts program for refugee children. It later expanded to include resources for adults and families. Sam Gabriel is Genesis executive director. He came to the U.S. in 1997, settling down in Des Moines with his parents. He and the rest of his siblings arrived a few years later. A lot of them secured their first jobs at Tyson Plant in Perry. Sam Gabriel says that his older brother still works there and his 18-year run will come to an end in June. Trisha Gabriel remembered first seeing this news about the permanent closure on Facebook. She thought of her brother-in-law and quickly shared the social media post with her husband. But the couple says they started to more fully understand the closure's impact only after a youth participant told them about her parents, who both are at Tyson, and they're afraid about what will happen when they lose their jobs. The Gabriels have teamed up with Iowa Workforce Development to host a series of career fairs that started on April 13th. Sam Gabriel says that these events are geared towards Tyson employees who live in Des Moines, and it will take place every second Saturday of the month at Hope and Elam Church, that is at 2500 University Avenue, until at least July. Genesis Youth Foundation is also looking for employers with openings to participate in this fair. Inquiries can be emailed to info@genesisyouthfoundation.org, and more information about Genesis can be found through the organization's website at genesisyouthfoundation.org. Iowa Workforce Development has already deployed career counselors to Perry through its mobile service. On Tuesdays from 11 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon, Workforce Development staff are posted on Tyson grounds to support those employees. Sam Gabriel says that he knows times like these are difficult, but he wants to make sure and reassure workers that help is on the way. He says, stay calm, have hope. We, the community as a whole, is working. There are many committed partners that are working towards making sure that no family would become homeless.
The Des Moines City Council is set to vote on a $975 million city budget. Des Moines City Council on Monday will vote on the city's nearly $975 million budget for the new fiscal year, which starts July 1. The proposed budget reflects a 21% decrease from the current amended $1.2 billion budget, which had funding carried over to cover construction on projects that were not completed at the end of fiscal year 2023. The budget also includes a general fund of about $259 million, which pays for the city's general services departments, such as public safety, parks, and libraries. If approved, police will make up the largest portion, 32%, or about $83 million, followed by fire at about 21%, according to the city's recommended operating budget. Here are the highlights from the proposed fiscal year 2025 budget. First, what's the new property tax levy in Des Moines? Des Moines' tax levy will remain unchanged at $16.61 per $1,000 of taxable valuation. Next, a look at staffing for police and fire departments. Des Moines is budgeting for a handful of new city positions in the upcoming year, including an equity liaison for the public safety departments, two police officers for downtown safety and security, a firefighter to run a 6-month mobile integrated health care pilot program to address a high volume of 911 calls, two building operators to help run city facilities such as the T.M. Franklin County City Administration Building at 1200 Locust Street, the Animal Rescue League's new Animal Control Center services at 1441 Harriet Street, and the coming Reichert Community Recreation Center that will be replacing the aging John R. Grubb Community YMCA at 1611 11th Street. A customer service representative and part-time staff for the expansion and operations at the Masonic Cemetery. During a budget meeting February 22nd, Des Moines Finance Director Nick Shaw said the city also will shift 5 positions from police and fire into the IT department. Other funds for a sobering center and the Animal Rescue League. If the budget is approved, the city will contribute $600,000 to the planned Polk County-owned Sobering Center to be named the Polk County Life Services Center at 1914 Carpenter Avenue, using funds from the local option sales tax and service tax. It's also set to increase its contribution to the Animal Rescue League to about $1.8 million to provide more staffing to run the new, larger animal control services facility. Additionally, City Manager Scott Sanders said the city needs to pay about $162,000 to keep the Grubb YMCA open until the new recreation center is constructed. The next section, pools, East Army Post Road improvements, and these are among long-term projects. Funding for the new projects is the city's 5-year capital budget, which pays for major construction, renovations, and repairs of city-owned buildings and infrastructure. These include $6.2 million for pool and aquatics infrastructure, $350,000 for the Waveland Golf Course Clubhouse expansion, $2 million for the Brian Melton Field, $22 million to improve East Army Post Road, and $1.2 million for lead services, water services. I think that is lead water services and not lead water services. What do you think? Is that, you think that's right, Nicole? We'll call that lead water services, presumably lead abatement in the water. And the final section, Des Moines to commit $1.5 million to DART from the general fund. The city will give $1.5 million to Des Moines Area Regional Transit Authority this fiscal year. The new funding marks the latest in ongoing conversations over how Des Moines could avoid significant cuts in DART bus services over the next several years. The city, at least for now, is choosing this route instead of increasing Des Moines' franchise fee and up to 2.5% tax on gas and electric bills to fund public transit. While increasing the franchise fee is not off the table, city leaders said in February they may not be an appetite on the Des Moines City Council to approve it. DART officials warned that the city's latest proposal will still require a 20% to 25% cut in services starting in November, less drastic than is expected 40% cut if Des Moines has done nothing, unless the council members can agree to a franchise fee. That could mean buses would run less frequently on local routes, on top of DART's plans to stop providing Wi-Fi on buses and start charging credit card fees. The city is slated to commit another $2.5 million to DART in the fiscal year 2026.
The last headline in the front page of the Des Moines Register is a national story, so we're going to get through the Metro and Iowa section first, and then we'll head on back to the main section. So in the Metro and Iowa section, the first story is justices reverse $790,000 of harassment verdict. Sorry about that. The suit claimed pattern of sexual conduct at the state office. This is from William Morris of the Des Moines Register. A bawdy office atmosphere among state social workers is not enough to support a nearly $800,000 jury verdict for sexual harassment, according to an Iowa Supreme Court ruling. The court's decision on Friday reverses the verdict for social work administrator Tracy White, who sued the Department of Human Services, now called the Department of Health and Human Services, in 2019, alleging a pervasive pattern of harassment and sexual conduct among employees in the department's Des Moines service area. Those claims included lewd and graphic remarks, such as a later fired supervisor joking about her wearing leather and whipping him, managers showing favoritism for more attractive and less assertive female employees, and a sexually charged atmosphere in which workers called women eye candy and also joked about the tightness of their clothing. White, who then continued to work for the department after filing this lawsuit, testified that she suffered depression, shingles, and other physical and mental harms from stress related to her hostile work environment. A jury agreed with her in May 2021 and awarded her $260,000 for past harms and $530,000 for future harm. Friday's Supreme Court ruling found that the district judge should have dismissed this case at the conclusion of the trial. The Iowa Attorney General's office did not immediately return messages seeking comment. Attorney Paige Fielder, who is representing White, said in an email that her client remains grateful for the jurors who decided her case and accused the court of a pattern of disregarding evidence and overriding jury's factual findings. She says, when judge chooses not to follow legal precedent, they normally overrule it or explain why it doesn't apply. They're not supposed to just simply omit any mention of prior cases that contradict their ruling. These activist judges have lost the respect of a great many of Iowa lawyers. They are in danger of losing respect of the people and any moral authority that may once have had. Over the course of the 11-day trial, jurors heard lurid accounts of workplace misconduct, including that another supervisor had groped coworkers and displayed sex toys in her office. The problem, the court said in Friday's unanimous ruling, is that White was hearing many of those details for the first time along with the jury. Although White testified to observing or hearing complaints about some incidents involving other employees, she also said that the other complaints, including some of the most graphic alleged misconduct, were new to her at trial. Holding that well-settled law prevents that plaintiffs from relying on the so-called Me Too evidence, of which they were not aware of, the court evaluated the case solely on what she personally experienced or was told about. On that basis, Justice Thomas Waterman wrote for the court, White failed to prove her case. Waterman wrote that, in our view, White failed to establish that she experienced sufficiently severe or pervasive conduct. In his ruling, he noted that White was never threatened, touched, or propositioned or pressured, nor threatened less favorably than male colleagues. Rather, he continued to write, she had generalized complaints that a manager was rude to her, gave her extra work, and favored a female coworker, specific complaints about a handful of inappropriate things said between 2015 and early 2019, mostly about other people, and the complaints that management failed to take prompt remedial measures. While the comments overheard by White about other coworkers' clothing, appearance, and sexual orientation may have been, quote, offensive and unprofessional, the fact that they were not about White herself diminishes their legal weight, Waterman wrote. We credit White's testimony that she was frustrated by the lack of remedial action at DHS, he wrote, but the harassment experienced by those workers and reported to her was not harassment that White personally experienced. Friday's decision follows another recent employment discrimination case where the court reversed a $1.4 million verdict for a Des Moines Area Community College IT worker who alleged that she was paid less than a male colleague because of her gender. White wasn't the only worker to sue over conditions in DHS Des Moines' office. In 2022, after White's verdict, the state settled social worker Jennifer Jackson's lawsuit alleging sexual harassment by a female supervisor that includes physical groping for nearly $1 million.
This next story is headlined, Auto Pioneers, Iowa Bicycle Shop Owners Develop the Famous Duesenberg. And this article is accompanied by several photographs. One is of a very old automobile, and it is being followed by another very old automobile. It looks like it's a very open space, but the caption reads, Billy Nipper drives the number 10 Henderson motor car, Henderson Duesenberg Racer, during the third running of the Indianapolis 500 in May of 1913. And if you didn't know from the caption that this was the Indianapolis 500, you'd probably never guess it. And there is another picture here of the two Duesenberg brothers, August and Fred, who were born in Germany. And on the inside, following up with this story, there are two more photographs, one of a 1929 Duesenberg Model J convertible sedan. Very fancy looking with lots of headlights. This is a head-on picture of it. You can see the grille and the front tires. It says it was on display in West Palm Beach, Florida. And the people around it look to be wearing fairly modern clothing. So I think this is probably an antique car or classic car event in West Palm Beach of this 1929 Duesenberg model. And my favorite of these photographs is of a picture taken in 1907 of a Mason motor car climbing the steps. Yes, you heard that right. Climbing the steps of the Iowa Capitol. They're driving it right up the steps of the Iowa Capitol as a display of the vehicle's power. So here's the story. As immigrants to Iowa from Germany in the 1890s, Friedrich would open a bicycle shop in Rockford while his younger brother August would open his own 42 miles west in Garner. By the early 1900s, the brothers, better known as Fred and Augie, were experimenting with gasoline engines and fashioning some of the first motorcycles, eventually carving their names into motoring history. They were the Duesenbergs, and before they were done, the classic car they developed would be prized by the biggest movie stars of their day and capture glory at the Indianapolis 500 and in other prestigious races. The brothers' start in the automobile world came in 1905 when they moved to Des Moines with the financial backing of attorney Edward R. Mason, and they began producing the Mason, a two-cylinder, 24-horsepower automobile known for its sturdiness and its power. It could perform such feats as scaling the west steps of the Iowa Capitol, just as shown in that picture that I described. Fred Maytag of Newton purchased majority ownership of the company in 1910 and moved it to Waterloo, where it became known as the Mason-Maytag Motor Company, and production was expanded to include four-cylinder cars. By 1913, Maytag sold out and carved his own name into history by starting a washing machine manufacturing company back in his hometown of Newton. But the Duesenbergs were not done. The brothers moved to St. Paul, Minnesota, where they founded Duesenberg Automobile and Motors Company, finding success as builders of race cars with engines that later were adapted for motorboats and airplanes as well. In the 1920s, Duesenberg race cars captured the checkered flag at three Indianapolis 500s, including the 1922, where they took seven of the top 10 places. A Duesenberg became the first American-made car to capture the French Grand Prix in 1926. By then, the Duesenbergs had expanded by opening plants in Chicago and New Jersey, but sold them to open a new plant in Indianapolis, where Fred Duesenberg became chief engineer and later president, and his brother became plant manager. In 1926, in a merger with L.E.L. Cord, who was manufacturing A 1926 merger with E.I. Cord, who was manufacturing Auburn automobiles, led to Fred Duesenberg designing the Model J in 1929, a car so luxurious and expensive for the time, with a price of $18,000, it became the darling of big-name stars of the day, such as Clark Gable, Gary Cooper, Greta Garbo, and Mae West. But at the height of the Duesenberg Model J's popularity in 1932, Fred Duesenberg died in an accident in one of his own cars. Production ended in 1937 when the Cord Company went bankrupt and was sold to the Aviation Corp. Augie Duesenberg tried to resurrect the Duesenberg after World War II, but he was unsuccessful and died of a heart attack in 1955. The spectacular design of the Duesenberg has often been associated with the phrase, "It's a doozy," referring to anything perceived as having superior value or making a vivid impression. However, Merriam-Webster Dictionary has found that the phrase actually dates to 1903, before the Duesenberg, though the car itself may have contributed to the popularity of the phrase.
And I have two short stories here. Quick Star is coming to Johnston from Chris Higgins of the Des Moines Register. A new Quick Star is coming to Johnston. A spokesperson for the gas station and convenience store chain confirmed to the Des Moines Register that construction on the new location at 5608 Merle Hay Road started this month. It will replace a former Johnston Community School District administrative building at the intersection with Pioneer Parkway. Tentative plans call for the new store to open on September 5th. A site plan approved by the Johnston City Council in April of 2023 shows 20 fuel stations, a 9,200-square-foot store, and also a detached car wash. Quick Star is the Iowa name for the Wisconsin-based chain Quick Trip, reportedly to avoid confusion with the similarly named Quick Trip with the Q. So, you know, like, yeah, you know, Quick Trip with the Q here in Iowa, and then that Wisconsin's base Quick Trip is with a K, so it's K-W-I-K. Confusing, right? Anyway, okay, so this company does have more than 800 locations in the Midwest. The rapidly growing brand is known for its fried chicken, hot meals, baked goods, Karuba coffee drinks, and also grocery store-style aisles. Quick Star had been expanding in the Des Moines metro in recent years, now with over 10 locations across Waukee, Urbandale, Des Moines, Pleasant Hill, Altoona, Ankeny, unincorporated Polk County, and Polk City. This new location has also been announced in Norwalk. And then the other short story I was going to read is a Q&A about how much higher will Dollar Tree prices will get. This is from Kate Keeley of the Des Moines Register. The days of dollar stores may soon be a thing of the past after the discount retail giant Dollar Tree announced that it would raise the price cap in its stores once again. The price hike also comes at a time when Family Dollars and Dollar Tree stores will start closing across the country. The company announced that it would close approximately 600 locations under the Family Dollar brand this year alone. In the coming years, about 400 Family Dollar and Dollar Tree locations will also close as the lease expire. So how much more are you going to have to pay at Dollar Tree? The price cap on items at Dollar Tree will now be $7. In 2021, the company raised the base price of items from $1 to $1.25. The cap was also raised in June of 2021 to $5 an item. The exact date hasn't been announced yet. Dollar Tree CEO say that in March, the increase will start in 2024 across all its stores. Dollar Tree CEO Rick Dreeling said in a call on March 13th, "This year, across 3,000 stores, we expect to expand our multi-price assortment by over 300 items at price points ranging from $1.50 to $7. The higher cost items will include food, pet, and personal care items, although not all the items will be at the $7 price cap." Dreeling says, "Over time, you will also see us fully integrate multi-price merchandise more into our stores so that our shoppers can find $5 bags of dog food next to our traditional $1.25 pet treats and toys, and our $3 bags of candies will be found in the candy aisle." Dollar Tree executive says that the demographics of their customers trending towards higher income brackets, according to USA Today. "The fastest growing demographic is north of $125,000 a year in income," Dreeling says, of the trend that the company sees across the country. "It's not like the Northeast is strong and the West is weak. That boat is lifting pretty even all the way up." There are 6 Dollar Tree stores here in Des Moines and 60 others across the state, according to the website. Family Dollar has 5 locations in Des Moines and operates in 47 other Iowa cities, according to its website. So sounds like Dollar Tree may need to consider a name change.
They might. They might want to start calling themselves the $7 store. Know the ground temperature before you start planting. With a warm February and wet March, how could gardeners not be eager to start planting? Frosting typically occurs between 33 and 36 degrees, according to Iowa State University. While frost generally causes minor damage to plants, there are species especially sensitive to a cold snap. Before you start digging, it's important to ensure the ground is warm enough to support your new flowers and vegetables. So what is the ground temperature in Iowa? The southern region of the state ranges from 47 degrees to a high of 54 degrees in one county as of Wednesday, according to the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. Counties north of Polk County were in the upper 40s with lows of 42 degrees. The ground is warmer than normal for this time of year. Ground in the southern and southeastern regions of Iowa are anywhere from 0.5 to 2 degrees warmer than normal, according to the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. You should check current conditions on the department's website. Well, how warm should the ground be before planting? Even though it feels warm out, Iowa's soil is still a bit cold. Plants' endurance to frost varies depending on the species. Vegetable gardens typically can begin outside once the soil hits 60 degrees during the day, according to Home Depot. The all-important question, when can I plant tomatoes in Des Moines, in Iowa? Tomatoes are a tropical plant, meaning they like warmth. Planting early can threaten the health of your crop. Soil temperatures should be about 60 degrees before setting the tomato plants into the garden, according to the University of New Hampshire. In southern Iowa, late April is typically the ideal time, while northern Iowa counties should wait until mid-May, according to Iowa State University Extension. When can I plant perennials in Iowa? Well, it doesn't feel like springtime if perennials are not swaying in the breeze. Spring is the traditional season to start growing perennials, according to Iowa State University. March and April are good times to start cleaning up any plant debris and leaves from the winter time before you start planting. Once the garden is ready to go, Iowa State University Extension advises gradually exposing any outdoor perennials before transplanting them in early spring. Coneflowers, Siberian iris, hostas, and catmint are just a few of the species that can typically endure the occasional frosts that are all too common in Iowa, according to Better Homes and Gardens. And finally, when can I plant potatoes in Iowa? Potatoes can go in the ground by early April in southern Iowa and late April for northern areas of the state, according to Iowa State University. Even though potatoes do well in cooler weather, they still need at least 6 hours of sun, according to HGTV. If you want to produce homegrown potatoes but don't want to wait, Red Golds, Yukon Gold, and Russet Norcota potatoes are all early season cultivars.
Cool. All right, we're going to get back to the main section of the Register, a front page story. A poll shows steep odds for Biden in Florida. The Democrats are expressing hope that abortion initiative will help flip the red state. Hours after the Florida Supreme Court cleared the way for an abortion access referendum to be on November's ballot, President Joe Biden's reelection campaign touted the state as being, quote, in play in 2024. Shifting from their once cautious stance on that state, Democrats argued the measure would drive turnout, particularly among progressive and younger voters, boosting Biden's prospects. But a new USA Today IPOS poll finds that Democrats continue to face significant headwinds in the Sunshine State. Passage of the ballot initiative that would expand access to abortion also faces an uphill battle. The court thrust abortion back into the spotlight with the ballot measure ruling, along with another decision that allows for a six-week ban to go into effect on May 1st. The competing measure, if passed, would guarantee abortion access up to viability, often 24 weeks. The USA Today this organization's poll shows that 50% of Florida voters said that they would be in favor of such an amendment, below the 60% majority that's required to pass it in November. Still, 16% said that they were either unsure or not registered to vote, a potential cash that Democrats and abortion advocates will need to tap into before Election Day. The poll shows that Democrats face a substantial enthusiasm gap about the 2024 election compared to Republicans, and former President Donald Trump, who calls Florida home, holds an 8-point lead over Biden in that state. In an election where everything may hinge on turnout, 67% of Democrats said that they were uncertain to vote in November compared to 80% of Republicans. The abortion issue could increase the number for Democrats, except only around 2/3 of Floridians said that they were familiar with the court allowing a 6-week ban to go into effect. Less than half of that, just half, said that they knew about the opposing amendment making the ballot. Concern for abortion or contraception fell generally along party lines. Reproductive rights were among the top issues for Democratic voters, behind cost of living and housing. For Republicans, the issue dropped down the list, below things like crime and immigration. While enthusiasm appears an uphill battle, with about 7 months until the election, Shauna Guderian, a political science professor at Syracuse University, said there's still plenty of time to get voters' attention. She says maybe people aren't enthusiastic about Joe Biden or Donald Trump, but they're going to care about other issues that are going to get them out to the polls. These candidates and the parties are going to have to do a lot of work to get them to understand what is at stake in this election. Biden's campaign has eyes on Florida, a state that's waffling between red and purple. Julie Chavez Rodriguez, Biden's campaign manager, said earlier this month, "We definitely see Florida in play and we're looking forward to running a strong effort there." But 39% of voters polled said that they would vote for Trump if this election were today, compared to 31% for Biden. Another Democrat with a tough road ahead is Senate candidate Debbie McCarsel Powell, of whom almost 75% of voters said that they had never heard. A former state representative, McCarsel Powell is challenging Republican Senator Rick Scott for his seat in November, but she trails him by 10 percentage points. Florida has been trending Republican the last three election cycles, and the GOP registration advantage versus Democrats has gone from a 200,000 deficit to outpacing their opponents by nearly a million voters. Trump defeated Hillary Clinton in that state by just over a point in 2016, and then he expanded that margin 4 years later, beating Biden by over 3 points. The Democrats were also hindered by low voter turnout 2 years ago, when Governor Ron DeSantis won re-election by 19 points. But despite these potential headwinds, Democrats have reason to be optimistic in the Sunshine State. Since the 2022 overturning of Roe v. Wade, the landmark 1973 case that provided a constitutional right to an abortion, constitutional amendments for abortion access have a perfect win record. Democratic candidates also saw electoral boosts from talking about reproductive rights in the 2022 midterms and the 2023 special elections. Meanwhile, abortion had been a weak spot for Republicans across the country, and it may prove just as tough for the Florida GOP. Rating the governor on various issues, 34% of voters says they approve of DeSantis' handling of abortion and contraception. DeSantis signed off on the 6-week abortion ban last April and had been a vocal opponent of the abortion access ballot measure. University of Central Florida political science professor Aubrey Drouet agreed that Democrats face an uphill battle in Florida for this year's election, but added that two proposed constitutional amendments may be their ace in this hole. Drouet says people who believe in a woman's right to choose, people who are already leaning Democratic, even independents, and some Republicans, do feel that 6 weeks of a ban is just too strict. Less than a quarter of Florida's voters said they would support a national version of Florida's 6-week limit. Among Republican voters, this support was just above 40%.
Today is tax day, and here's what you need to do if you need more time. The tax season is coming to a close. If you do not know this, you probably haven't filed your taxes yet. And if you haven't, you are not alone. According to Forbes, the Internal Revenue Service has received 1.7% fewer returns this tax season and has processed 2% fewer returns as of March 1 compared to 2023. The average tax refund issued by the IRS is $3,182 as of March 1, a 5.1% increase compared to the same window in 2023. However, this trend may not continue because, according to Barron's, refund amounts decreased by 13% between March and April in 2023. Here's what to know about tax return deadlines and extension requests. For the majority of Americans, the last day to file a tax return with the IRS is Monday, April 15. To avoid interest and penalties, if you miss the deadline, consider requesting a 6-month extension before tax day. Iowans have a little more time to file their state tax return. Iowa income taxes are due by Tuesday, April 30th. The Iowa Department of Revenue does not offer an extension form. However, if you have paid at least 90% of your tax liability by April 30th, you can take until October 31 to file your return. Monday, April 15 is the deadline to file an extension. The IRS states that if you live in certain disaster areas, you may qualify for an extension where you will not be required to submit an electronic or paper request. Those who file a tax return extension will have until Tuesday, October 15, 2024 to file. Requesting an extension is free through the IRS. To file, you need the following information: your name and address, estimated tax liability, how much payment you owe, and your Social Security number. Individual tax filers can request an extension electronically through the IRS Free File. The paper extension version is known as Form 4868 and can be mailed, but be sure it is postmarked no later than April 15. The standard penalty for missing the tax deadline is 5% of any tax due for every month the return is late, which is up to 25% of the unpaid balance. Failing to pay any taxes owed upon filing or receiving an extension will charge a monthly penalty of 0.5% of unpaid amounts. The IRS states an extension to file is not an extension to pay. In Iowa, if there is an underpayment discovered during an audit or examination, another 5% penalty will be added to the unpaid tax, according to the Iowa Department of Revenue. And there's a short follow-up story. That story that I just read is from the Des Moines Register, reporters Kate Kiely and Nina Tron. But there is a follow-up article here from USA Today on how to extend a file for an extension on tax returns. And I'm guessing there's a little repeated information here, but let's take a look at this anyway. Sometimes, they say, people just need more time, and there are options for those who could not meet the deadline for filing tax returns. It is not recommended to delay filing with the IRS. However, circumstances may impact a filer's ability to meet the deadline. An extension, if approved, provides filers a 6-month grace period to file, though it does not provide an extension to pay. If a filer does not pay, they will face penalties and interest charges. Even if you cannot finish your tax return, make a payment. That can help reduce the penalties and interest, said Larry Pond, a certified public accountant and tax professor at the College of San Mateo. The deadline to file an extension is Monday, today. The IRS says people may qualify for an extension and do not need to submit a request electronically or on paper if they live in certain disaster areas. For those granted an extension, their deadline to file a tax return is October 15. According to Intuit TurboTax, reasons a person might ask for an extension on their tax return include unexpected life events, incomplete documentation, discovering errors on a filing, or simply running out of time. Taxpayers can request an extension for free through the IRS. Basic information will be needed, like name, address, Social Security number, estimated tax liability, and a payment if a filer owes anything. Regardless of income, individual tax filers can use IRS Free File to request an extension electronically. Those who prefer to mail a paper version of the extension, called Form 4868, should make sure that it is postmarked no later than today.
And we have some developing news from the online version of the Des Moines Register. A 12-year-old Iowa boy is in custody this morning after a 13-year-old girl is found dead in a reported shooting. This is from Jose Mendiola of the Des Moines Register. A 12-year-old is in custody in relation to a shooting that left a 13-year-old dead, the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation said in a news release. The Eldora Police Department and the Hardin County Sheriff's Office officials were dispatched to the 800th block of 12th Street in Eldora around 5:30 yesterday for a report of a shooting. This is according to a special agent in charge at the Iowa DCI. A 13-year-old girl was then found dead and a 12-year-old boy was taken into custody. Officials did not release any more information on the people involved. The State Department was called to assist, and the investigation is ongoing. All information on this case will be forwarded to the Hardin County Attorney's Office for review. South Hardin School Superintendent Dr. Adam Zellmer said in a news release, a student who attended South Hardin Middle School had died. Members of the district's counseling staff will be in school for student support, he says. He also said in the news release, please keep the families involved, our students and our staff, in your thoughts and prayers in the days ahead.
U.S. agencies target cartel bosses over fentanyl. This is a USA Today story, and it's Dateline Phoenix, Arizona. Federal agencies are targeting cartel leadership and focusing resources on Arizona's southern border to curb the flow of fentanyl into the United States. The strategy, called Operation Plaza Spike, is part of a multi-agency effort to disrupt illicit synthetic drug smuggling into the U.S. and stop the illegal exportation of weapons from the U.S. to the cartels in Mexico. The operation will go after high-ranking cartel officials and their associates. A plaza is a territory controlled by a Mexican cartel, often directly south of the U.S. border crossing. According to U.S. Customs and Border Protection, the drug trade through Mexico plazas has accelerated the use of synthetic drugs such as fentanyl, among others. We're going after the plaza bosses whose organizations are responsible for virtually everything that is smuggled into the U.S. via the southwest border, said Troy Miller, a senior official performing the duties of a CBP commissioner. The strategy will involve various activities, including revoking visas for known cartel members and scrutinizing related cross-border business entities and trade. While the operation is focusing on transnational criminal organizations, law enforcement will continue to target U.S. citizens who smuggle illicit drugs, Miller said. Federal data shows fentanyl is primarily smuggled by U.S. citizens, according to the Cato Institute. Miller said this new phase to combat fentanyl is part of ongoing efforts to illuminate and understand the networks, logistics, routes, and tactics, techniques, and procedures used by transnational criminal organizations operating within Arizona. The area south of Nogales, Arizona, and Nogales, Mexico, is controlled by Sergio Valenzuela, a Sinaloa cartel plaza boss, who was indicted in 2021 and remains a fugitive. This area is responsible for 44% of fentanyl seizures, Miller said. From October to February, CBP seized 222,000 pounds of drugs, including 8,000 pounds of fentanyl. During that same period, the agency seized more than 1,600 weapons and nearly 200,000 rounds of ammunition. James Nunley, Deputy Chief of Operations for the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, said the Sinaloa and Jalisco New Generation cartels are the two organizations causing worst drug crisis in our nation's history, with a presence in 50 countries. He goes on to say, knowing who the greatest threats are and understanding how and where they operate is key to DEA strategy. The DEA is using a network approach to disrupt the cartel's global supply chain, with two task forces dedicated to investigating each cartel and a third task force that targets the global illicit finance networks used by both cartels, he said. The agency also is targeting these Chinese chemical companies responsible for supplying the ingredients to make fentanyl. Last year, the Department of Justice charged 8 people from 4 Chinese chemical manufacturing companies with illegally trafficking the chemicals used to make fentanyl.
We have about 5 minutes, so let's take a look at some 50 states headlines. Today's highlight is out of Georgia and Savannah. When General William Sherman seized Savannah, the Montemolin building at City Market was confiscated by the federal government. Once a building where enslaved persons were sold, the building was then given to Savannah's African American community. That move paved the way for the Savannah Educational Association to open one of Savannah's first legal black schools, the Byron School, which then went on to host as many as 400 students in one session, according to city archives. Now, a historical marker on Bernard Street across from the Ellis Square tells the story of both tragedy and triumph. Now let's take a look at some Midwest states. We'll start in Springfield, Illinois, where the mascot at Nokomis High School had been the Redskin since a 1920 vote among the town's voters. This town, home to 2,100 residents, itself is named after a Native American mythological figure that's featured in a Henry Wadsworth Longfellow poem. Legislation being considered in Springfield would do away with Nokomis' mascot, along with every public K-12 school in that state using a Native American name, logo, or mascot. In New Carlisle, Indiana, despite a slowdown in EV sales, General Motors is now moving forward with a $3.5 billion battery plant that it's building with Samsung SDI that's near New Carlisle. Here in Des Moines, Governor Kim Reynolds and the Iowa Department of Education announced a new plan to help school districts and community organizations feed youth in need during the summer. Through the Summer Meal Program Expansion Grant, $900,000 in grants are now up for grabs for local groups that's seeking to offer healthy meals and snacks for children and teens over the summer break. In Topeka, Kansas, a transgender inmate at the Kansas Women's Prison in Topeka has so far failed to convince a federal judge that she is being discriminated against. In Detroit, Michigan, last year, Michigan Democrats spent big on corporate subsidies. Now they want to divert hundreds of millions of already committed corporate income tax revenue away from the state's major economic development fund. Governor Gretchen Whitmer has touted the fund as key to job growth and also maintaining Michigan's competitive edge as the auto industry transitions into EVs. In St. Paul, Minnesota, Monday is tax day, and Democratic Governor Tim Walz doesn't want parents to miss out on the state's nationally ranked child tax credit. Bold predictions of the credit's impact show that the child poverty in Minnesota would decrease by 33%. In Springfield, Missouri, long-awaited repairs for the Jefferson Avenue footbridge are now in the works, just moving along at a different timeline than initially expected. In Lincoln, Nebraska, efforts to revert Nebraska's electoral system to winner-takes-all of the presidential popular vote are being reignited as Republican Governor Jim Pillen and other GOP state leaders push for a special legislative session to get a bill passed. And to Bismarck, North Dakota, the Spirit Lake Tribe of North Dakota and the Menominee Nation of Wisconsin filed a lawsuit against TikTok, Meta, YouTube, and social media companies, alleging that social media addiction contributes to high Native American teen suicide rates. And in Columbus, Ohio, Columbus-based Grange Insurance is now working on an app to help teach teen drivers and point out problematic practices. But current state law requires certified driving instructors to teach 8 hours of behind-the-wheel training. In response, Ohio lawmakers introduced a House Bill 425 and Senate Bill 218, which would allow for student drivers to complete 8 hours of in-car training with instruction from an app. If this passes, Ohio would be among the first states to allow app-based driver's education training. We have a few more, and then we'll be off to birthdays. Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. The Oklahoma City Planning Commission has recommended the City Council approving zoning for proposed 1907-foot high tower, but they warned that they do not like the renderings that show extensive use of LED signage throughout the four-tower development. And in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, the South Dakota Department of Agriculture and Natural Resources is reporting avian influenza, or bird flu. It was detected in a South Dakota dairy cattle herd. Finally, in the Midwest, out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, it's clear that the hundreds of vacant teaching positions that Wisconsin's teaching workforce is in trouble. A new state report crystallizes this issue with data from the 2021-2022 school year. In the 2021 to 2022 school year, the median salary for Wisconsin teachers was $57,279, according to the report. Adding benefits, total median compensation $81,000. That's a 13% drop in median pay and 19% drop in median compensation since 2010.